Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
That's all right. And then got it.
Hello and welcome to New Books Network. I'm your host, Mark Hudson, and my guests today are Professor Judith Shapiro at the American University in the USA and Professor John Andrew McNeish, who's at the Norwegian University of Life Sciences. We'll be discussing their recent edited volume, Our Extractive Age, Expressions of Violence and Resistance, which is published by Routledge in as part of their studies of extractive industries and sustainable development. And the project that sits underneath the book was sponsored by the Directorate of for the Internationalization of Education in Norway. So if we could begin with brief introductions from both of you, you first, Judith, sort of who you are, what you're generally interested in, and when extractivism became a big part of what you do, and why?
Well, thank you for having us here today. It's a thrill. I teach primarily about China, and I've researched about China since really the mid-1970s. And I'm mostly interested in authoritarianism and the environment as far as it affects China domestically. But in recent years, China has gone out on the so-called Belt and Road, and that has led to what we could call an intensification of the metabolism of globalization, if you will. And so China has joined the bandwagon of developed countries extracting resources from the developing world. And I've been very interested in how that's playing out. I think it's a dramatic sort of tipping point for the planet, if you will, the arrival of China on the scene. So I've done lots and lots of books on China, on the Cultural Revolution, on China's environmental challenges domestically, and then most recently a book called China Goes Green, Coercive Environmentalism for a Troubled Planet. And we can talk about that later. So thank you.
And John Andrew, same questions to you, if you be so kind.
Thanks, Mark. So I have a background as an anthropologist who has worked not in China, but rather in Latin America for many years. Really initially sort of coming off the back of PhD research focused on indigenous politics and in questions around the development of indigenous communities. I've really, moved over time in response to really the experiences of the communities that I worked with, really in time to focus more and more on extractive politics in the region of Latin America. I've had an experience of being of doing research in Bolivia, in Guatemala, and also in Colombia. And in each of those countries, the issue of extractive politics has become intensified as processes of extraction also intensified from the late 1980s, early 1990s onwards. Latin America has always been a region which, at least since the conquest, has been a region that has been stripped for its natural resources. Many of its nations have built their economies and their political systems on the basis, in fact, of extraction of natural resources. But in the 1990s, early 1990s onwards, there was a real boom in the extraction of natural resources across Latin America. And so all of those countries that I have worked in, all of them experienced a major intensification of the extraction of natural resources. And that would have direct impact at a national level in terms of changing the course of politics and economics, but also would have a very significant effect, significant impact on local communities, including those communities that I had previously worked on, i.e. Indigenous communities or peasant communities in that region of the world.
Thanks very much. And going on from here, whichever one of you wants to answer a question, obviously you're both welcome to. And something that you touched on there, and you both touched on, is this question of an intensification in the 1990s. But what would you say to someone who says, well, extractivism is simply, the term extractivism is simply a new label for something that's been going on for 500 years, or you could say that the Roman Empire was extractivist. So what is it that you mean by extractivism? How long has it been going on for? Is it just another word for eco-imperialism? And if it's something new, what's new about it? Is it satellites and container ships and high-speed rail, or is it something else?
Ginny, you want me to go first? Is that okay? I mean, Mark, you know, when we're talking about extractivism, I mean, it's fair enough to make a connection to earlier perspectives, to look at this as an extension of capitalism, to look at this as the extension of primitive accumulation, to look at this as the extension of earlier experiences of empire and imperialism. All of that, I think, is correct to say that this is, you know, it can be connected. When we're talking about extractivism, we can connect it to that. But there are some differences that we wanted to flag with this book when we're thinking of, you know, and talking about extractivism directly. One is that we wanted to really place an emphasis on the fact that this is a logic, there's a particular means or mode of thinking, which has intensified. It's not that it's new necessarily, but that this has intensified in our recent times, an intensified logic where we're not just carrying out processes of natural resource extraction, but we're talking about a form or logic where that extraction does no longer have any limits. It is extractivism. It is a logic of removal, a logic of erasure, which I think also is important to say, we know as being something which is global in nature. It's no longer something just to be found in discrete enclaves of extraction. We are now looking at what we would have called in this book a planetary assemblage. Michael Watts's piece at the end of the book is extremely good in terms of actually describing in very rich detail, in fact, what that planetary assemblage looks like. And so that's what we're getting at, you know, a logic, but then also a logic which is of a planetary or a global nature.
And if I can add, we also explored in the book some new forms of extraction, because traditionally we think about mining and fisheries and timber and oil and natural gas. But we also discovered that we can find extraction in controlling supply chains and in the digital world and in the built environment and a whole series of places. I mean, we could talk a little bit about how that came to be in that many of the scholars involved with the book are from a big, wide range of disciplines. And so often the study of extraction is something that anthropologists, environmental justice people, political ecologists tend to focus on, but less so perhaps the political scientists and the lawyers and the economists. And so we've brought in a whole range of people from a whole range of disciplines to find, basically to create a cross an interdisciplinary conversation about this whole concept of extraction. And we could actually define three areas. You know, there's extraction, which is just simply the act of extracting. There's extractivism, which is the logic that John just described. And then there's a new sort of way of looking at this, which is extractivism, where you capitalize the letter A, and that has to do with the resistance, the activism involved in the face of all of this extraction. So we explore all three of those concepts in the book.
Thanks both. And that did strike me when I was reading just the autobiographies of all the individual chapters, that it wasn't half a dozen anthropologists from one small cluster of universities and a sprinkling of other people. So perhaps if you could tell us a bit about both the impetus for the book, did you bump into each other at a conference and realize that you were both tackling the same issues and then start to work together, or is it something else? And then if you could just talk briefly about the sort of the mechanics, the process of bringing together this edited volume. And it seems to have been at least finished during the pandemic. So was there sort of extra difficulties, or was it easier there?
Julie, you want to start?
In many ways, our Norwegian donors should be very happy about this book, because I don't think the book would have been written without the grant. And the grant was a rather complex grant. It was intending to create a whole range of interactions between the Norwegian University of Life Sciences and a particular program within the School of International Service at American University in Washington, namely the Global Environmental Politics Program. And so there was money in the grant to exchange students and to co-teach courses and all kinds of stuff like that. But part of the grant was also to create a joint research project. And so in the initial phases, it was simply a question of the scholars from the different universities spending a week here or 2 weeks there at each other's universities. And then eventually a larger group of people from Norway came to the US, and we spent some time brainstorming. And our task was essentially to figure out what is the burning issue that we all feel is important enough and that we all have something to say about, you know, that should then be the basis for this collaboration. So that's how it happened. And John and I were the lucky people, each of us at our different universities, to be named as the head of this so-called research, what do they called it? The research work package, they called it. So John and I were thrown together, and I guess I feel lucky to know John and to have worked with John. But for me, this field is, I would say it's less of a long-term core research focus for me than it probably is for John. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but as I said earlier, I've been primarily focused on intellectual freedom in China, you know? So, and China's only come late in the game to this whole extraction effort. So I have learned a lot from this process. I don't know what John wants to add to that description of our process.
I mean, for me, this was an extension of work that I had been doing anyway. So this is, you know, a field where I have already done some research and already done some writing. Actually, just to have another book out, since it might be of interest as well to those that are listening, I have another book that's just come out called Sovereign Forces, Everyday Challenges to Environmental Governance in Latin America, which is again another book which exploring a particular element of extractive politics in Latin America. So I have an experience of working in this field. But I think that, I mean, Judy actually, although I may be the one who has this kind of the strongest foundation looking at extractive politics, Judy's the one that really created this opportunity in the first place. It's really off the back of Judy coming to visit Norway and finding her way to us here at the Norwegian University of Life Sciences and finding out that actually that we are very, you know, we're very much sister institutions. We are institutions that have similar areas of teaching and research, albeit from somewhat different perspectives and takes. We're both environments that are concerned with issues of environmental governance, and we're both departments as well that have a strong focus on political ecology as well. And so there are very good matches actually to be found between our two environments and between the people that we have here. Having said that, we've also added in this book, we've also over time added other voices as well to the book that we felt were necessary in order to give further solidity to the book and to its foundations within extractive politics.
Thanks both. That's interesting how different projects come from, obviously, from different places. And there are a large number of chapters in here, and I want to talk about at least a few of them. Before we do that, though, one citation that came up repeatedly, as you'd expect, is the Nixon quote around, around slow violence. And I was wondering if either of you would like to first explain what's meant by slow violence for any listeners who don't know, but also maybe how your conceptualization of extractivism challenges or sits alongside or above or below this notion of slow and maybe complicates this notion of slow violence.
Do you want me to take it first, Judy? Okay. So with slow violence, we are, I guess, we're piggybacking, as others have done as well, off of the back of the work done by Nixon and off of work that's really been focused primarily on looking at the impact of pollution and contamination, the way that extractive processes result in pollution and contamination, where the effects of that are not immediately obvious, but it takes time as this pollution contamination seeps into the earth, seeps into the water resources, seeps into the air. It's only over time that the consequences of that impact on the environment becomes evident. And what we're, you know, saying is that's the case as well with a whole range of you know, extractive processes and extractive impacts that, you know, when we're talking about physical transformations, but we're also looking at extractive processes which are more, you know, the non-physical in terms of perhaps intellectual extraction, looking at other kind of, you know, when we're thinking about data, when we're talking about knowledge, et cetera, the evidences of the impacts are not immediately evident. They take time to become evident. And you can connect that as well to this idea of a global assemblage as well, is that many parts of that global assemblage will often remain hidden for us because of the distance between, you know, points of consumption and points of extraction. And so the, you know, things become distant and are not made obvious to us, at least initially, parts of that system only become evident as time goes on, as we become more aware as well of the interconnections that exist in our planet between all of the processes that connect up this global extractive system. You know, one of the things that I think that we also wanted to stress as well is that, you know, that the way in which this has become evident to many in recent years is because actually it's no longer the case that extraction takes place always on, you know, very sort of discrete places on the other side of the planet. You know, now if we can extract the notion of extractivism to also, for example, to renewable energy resources, if we can expand as well to thinking about agricultural resources, we can begin to see, in fact, that it's evident, the impacts are becoming evident actually on our doorsteps. It's no longer a far away thing. It's not a process which is, held invisible because of distance. More and more of this assemblage is becoming evident to us as it encroaches ever closer to our homes.
Mm-hmm. And just one thing to add about the slow violence issue. The book is not only about slow violence, it's also about fast violence. And in fact, over the last very short period of time, the murders of what are called land defenders have gone skyrocketing in number. I remember when I first started teaching about basically environment and human rights, and the number of so-called environmental martyrs you could almost put on the fingers of one hand, Chico Mendes, or this very, very small number of people who were murdered in the name as they were trying to protect the land. And now the documents say that they're really literally hundreds and hundreds of these people are killed every year. So that's really featured in a couple of the articles, particularly the ones about Latin America.
Yeah. No, I mean, the statistics that are being revealed now by organizations such as Global Witness are very shocking. So last year was the year with the highest rate of killings of what they determine as being land defenders. Land defenders is a very broad category which covers, everything from environmentalists to human rights activists concerned with the impacts of extractive processes to indigenous peoples who are just trying to defend their community, etc. And the numbers of people being killed and targeted are rising. And with that, we should also acknowledge that it's not only about killings, it's about threats, it's about displacement from land, etc., etc. So this is increasing as we go on. And it's kind of, it's not only it's not only shocking with thought about the impacts of fossil fuel production, but it's also shocking when if we expand this category of extractivism to other forms of resources, including renewables, including efforts to try and build wind power parks or solar arrays or so on. Problematically, very problematically, we're also seeing also targeted assassinations and also threats being made to communities that are also similarly up in arms or protesting those kinds of projects. So it's not just something, these kinds of violent impacts are not only to be attributed to, in a classical sense, to fossil fuel development, but it is also to be attributed as well to, unfortunately, what we might now call the green transition or processes of the green economy.
If I can add something about that, just with respect to China, the Belt and Road Initiative is focusing primarily on infrastructure, and that's deep water ports, high-speed rail, highways, dams, power plants, and all of those infrastructure projects, in addition to being massive carbon emitters and facilitators of the global trade that increases the amount of carbon that is being emitted, also carves up landscapes and transforms livelihoods. So when you build a highway or a railroad through a rainforest, you're not just dividing it in half, but you're providing the inroad literally for a whole set of capillaries that will ultimately eat away habitat for people and habitat for non-human living beings. So I would say the Belt and Road is very, very impactful in terms of the kind of both slow and fast violence that we are describing. And a lot of these projects, the Chinese are completely surprised because they often sign a deal with some kind of member of the elite and they seem to have permission to build the dam or whatever it is. And they have no experience in dealing with communities. They have no concept of indigenous rights. And so when there are then protests, they're caught completely off guard and they tend to handle the situation rather poorly.
So very quickly, if we can just touch on the two chapters that you were co-authors on. Judith, if you could just say a three-sentence definition of what is the Belt and Road and what your chapter found.
Okay,
in a few more than three sentences.
Yeah. Okay, well, my co-author, Yifei Li, is a professor at NYU Shanghai. And we chose, actually, rather than to focus on the things I just described in terms of deep water ports and all that, we chose to look at extractivism that you might not expect to find on the Belt and Road. The Belt and Road is just China's umbrella term for China's massive going out strategy. And it started as a land route to revivify the old Silk Road and then adding a kind of a sea route around South Asia. But now it's just everything you want. There's a Latin America is on the Belt and Road, and there's a polar Belt and Road, and there's a dairy Belt and Road, and there's an outer space Belt and Road. So, you know, whatever you want, it's still there. But so what we decided to do was to find three places where you might not expect to find extraction on the Belt and Road. That's not about China buying up grain fields or Peru's anchovy fisheries or all that, which is also incredibly important. Rather, we discovered that we're talking about tourism extraction. That when the Chinese travel, they're not very experienced at this time, and so to reassure them, the Chinese state has basically built mini Chinas, particularly in Samarkand. So they go off to Samarkand and they can visit the mosque and the marketplace, but then they can go to a place that just reminds them exactly of the drum tower back home in Beijing, right? So this kind of extraction of culture, it's eradication of culture also. That's one form of extractivism that we discovered. We also profiled the dairy Belt and Road, which has more to do with the control of the supply chain between China and New Zealand and Australia with respect to dairy products. And the final bit of extractivism that's, again, unconventional extractivism is the extraction of talent. And we explored the way China is seeking to develop talented people in developing countries and make it very much in their interest to take study tours to China, to learn the Chinese way, and basically to throw their lot in with China rather than with the West. That's yet another kind of unconventional extraction. That was our chapter.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Okay, I mean, that last sort of talent spotting and grabbing is something that empires have always wanted to do, because of course smart people might want their country back, and if you can get them to be conflicted and not trusted by colleagues who didn't go to the metropole, then it gives you more time as an empire. But I digress. John Andrew, do you quickly want to explain sort of why rivers should have rights, and also touch on this extra activism concept that you introduce in your chapter?
So, I mean, the subtitle to our book is Violence and Resistance. And so as much as we've talked about, you know, the dominant ontology of extractivism, we've also observed that there are counter ontologies. There are other ways of thinking about the world as well. And that those other ways of thinking about the world, interestingly, are beginning to have expression in legal terms, in legal cases, in fact. And so the chapter I wrote together with Whitney Richardson, Whitney was a former master student of mine, who's now actually a candidate in law over in the United States. This chapter that we wrote was written off the back of the master's thesis work that she'd done, the master's research that she'd done on the Atrato case, which is one of these cases where a court ruling has found in favor of the subject rights of the river, right? So recognizing the river as though it was, in fact, a subject of rights, therefore, as it were almost an individual, a human individual that should be provided with, as a human individual, forms of protection. And this was a court case also judging where there was a judgment really about the actions of the Colombian state and its failure to live up to a protection of constitutional rights. So this is one case actually of many. There are now a number of cases like this which are cropping up across the world. I'm also part of a project that has been recently funded by the Norwegian Research Council, a project called Riverine Rights, where we are looking at a number of similar cases to the Atrato case, where we're looking at, for example, the cases that occurred in India surrounding the Ganges River, the Narmada River, and the Yamuna River. We're looking also at the Wanganui River case in New Zealand. And so that's these were the first cases of that nature, where there were rulings in favor of the subject rights of these rivers. There is, however, now there's actually a growing number of these cases, some of which have not come to conclusion, and some of which have come to conclusion from other places across the world. And so it's actually very much a part of a global trend, and part of a global trend, not only where there's a concern about the rights of rivers, but also concern as well with the rights of nature. And so, in fact, as well as rivers, these cases now increasingly also look to other features of our natural world, forests, mountains, lakes, parts of the Amazon, etc., etc. So there's a real trend of this, of an expanding trend, finding in favor of the subject rights of rivers. And of course, you know, this, what we might call an ecocentric trend, is very different from our earlier understandings of rights around resources, because earlier, you know, rulings have more commonly been about the rights of the human populations surrounding those rivers to access and use of those rivers. But here we're finding, in fact, in favor of the subject rights of the rivers. There's a real change in the logics, one that very much confronts also previous economic rationality, previous rationalities of valuing nature with a dollar sign, or only purely in economic terms. Here there's very much an emphasis as well on understanding these rivers as entities, and therefore a shift is being made as well in a direction which is a direction that we're also, you know, has been an increasing trend within social theory, across, in fact, the social sciences, in terms of what we might call as post-humanism, of moving towards an understanding of the fact that humans and nature are not separate, and that also that nature itself or elements of nature have agency in their own right. And so these ecocentric law cases are efforts to try and recover that and put that forward into the political debate. And very much of, you know, these legal cases have really created enormous debates in each of the countries that they've taken place with regards to how we understand nature, but also what this also means in terms of changes that might be made to environmental governance, recognizing the rights of these particular nature subjects.
So thanks very much for explaining your two chapters, but of course there are many other chapters in this book. Judith, could you explain just quickly what the other chapters are about?
Well, the book is structured in three parts. So the first part is theoretical, thinking about what violence means, what extraction means, what extractivism means, what extra activism means. And so those contributors include people from Finland. We had quite a big contingent of people from Finland who contributed quite a lot, and also scholars from the Norwegian University of Life Sciences, Katharina Glob and Kirsti Stuvoy, and then Paul Wapner from my university. And then the middle section is a mostly empirical section where we talk about the intensification of violence at the local level. And there we have chapters on Latin America from Garrett Grady Lovelace, and an interesting chapter on the built environment from an architect who works with me called Vicky Kichel. And Philippe Le Billon and Nicholas Middledorp contributed a chapter about free, prior, and informed consent, rather free, prior, and informed consultation, which often doesn't, according to them, doesn't always work as it's intended to. And then the final big section is about the innovative new ways that we're seeing extractivism in the new era. And so that includes my chapter on the Belt and Road, as well as the chapter John was describing about the rights of rivers, a chapter also from the Finns or the Finnish contingent on digital extraction, and also very interesting chapter from my colleague Simon Nicholson on geoengineering and how the extraction of carbon from the atmosphere is also a place, you know, we wouldn't expect to find extractivism. And then because Michael Watts wrote such a sort of tour de force final chapter, we gave him a standalone section because I think it really summarizes all of those different dimensions. Maybe John would be best to describe that chapter a little bit more.
Yeah, I can certainly try. You know, it's as Judy said, it was such a tour de force. It was such an expansive piece. And on reflection, Judy and I felt that we really need to actually give it its due by actually creating an entire section of the book for one chapter. I mean, Michael Watts is a well-known writer on oil politics, and specifically on oil politics in Nigeria. He's also considered to be one of the fathers as well of political ecology, as well as a political geographer. And this chapter is a really wonderful piece, and a piece that certainly adds to our book in a strong way. It's a chapter that's titled Hyper-Extractivism and the Global Oil Assemblage, Visible and Invisible Networks in Frontier Spaces. And what it does is, I mean, it very much demonstrates what I've talked about previously in this interview about the planetary nature of extractivism and the fact that this planetary system is built up of an assemblage of many, many different parts, some of which are tangible and some of which are intangible, are unseen, some of which are legal and other parts that are clearly very illegal as well, and that these things, that the illegal and the legal, they actually rely on each other. They can't be one without the other. And so it goes through, you know, many, many aspects. First of all, dealing with the fact that, you know, we are seeing an intensification of extractivism. Michael refers to the term hyper-extractivism, which is a term that we've also taken up more broadly speaking in the book as well, to talk about this intensification process. He talks about the way in which this assemblage is also extending itself into areas that were previously considered to be, you know, inconceivable with regards to oil extraction. And so now we're seeing, of course, the expansion of oil drilling into the far Arctic, into the far north, whether it be, you know, the Bering Sea, or whether it be other parts of the Arctic that, you know, were previously, because of technological limits, were basically impossible. And now they are being increasingly made possible by the introduction of new technologies. As I said, he also explores this whole relationship between the illicit and the licit, the legal and the illegal, talking very much about the way in which there is the formation around the legal market for oil, also the formation as well of markets for smuggled fuel or the bunkering of oil, and the way in which that also has its fingers, has its linkages as well into interesting networks within international finance. And so that also the international finance and the international trading system is also, you know, made complicit in this whole process of the legal and the illegal. One feeds off the others. So he also has an interesting section exploring the illicit life of a barrel of oil, essentially trying to sort of say that, you know, something about, you know, the take, you know, the barrel of oil and look at all aspects of how that barrel of oil is transported and moved into the global economy. And so the illicit and the illicit is explored in that. And linking to that also different kinds of ontologies. So thinking about the intangible as well, the way in which, oil is understood differently by different communities, by different actors within that global assemblage. Linking to piracy, thinking about consumption and the after oil, the afterlife of oil, the oil once it arrives, on the other end of at the other end of the assemblage, that it will be made use of either as a source of fuel for maybe heating and lighting, but also in terms of petrochemical production and so on. So there are other ways in which we have to acknowledge that oil is transformed from one form into many other forms in which our global capitalist system relies. I mean, in our everyday lives, in fact, are entirely reliant as well on that barrel of oil for almost every product that we would see around us, whether it be at home or whether it be in the office, relies very much on those on that oil. So yeah, and looking at political and logistical orders, the invisible supply chain, many different elements here, logistics, finance and first trades, contract theft, commodity traders. As I said, an extremely expansive chapter for our book, and very much one that I think that captures the complexity of that global assemblage, and also captures as well that the notion here as well that there are violences being expressed in the trade for oil, which go beyond the physical, which become very clearly structural, ontological, symbolic as well. And so that we clearly see that the impacts then of this system are very, very diverse.
I'd just like to make some closing observations from what you've both said, if you'll indulge me. One is this notion of sort of exhausting one arena and then having to go looking elsewhere in more difficult to find places using new technologies reminds me of a book by the anthropologist Marvin Harris called Cannibals and Kings, where he argues that the search for protein meant that once you'd killed off all the slow-moving megafauna and you still needed your protein, you'd go hunting for harder to find things and harder to find things. The other is maybe less highbrow. It's an article from the Onion newspaper published shortly after the Deepwater Horizon disaster. And I've always thought that the clue was in the name there twice. Deepwater and Horizon both tell you that this is places that oil companies didn't need to used to go because there was more low-hanging fruit. But anyway, the Onion article says, major environmental disaster as oil tanker safely reaches port and unloads. And then it traces the damage caused by the normal operating of the system, where there are no spills. There's nothing goes wrong. And I suppose the final thing I'd say is that the modern environmental movement, if you want to call it that, began in the late 60s, famously with that river, I can never say the name, Cuyahoga, whatever, you know, briefly catching fire, and the Santa Barbara oil spill. And sort of the last big oil spill that seemed to rouse us as a species, I mean, you'd have to say it was Exxon Valdez or possibly Deepwater Horizon. But by the time of Deepwater Horizon, everybody kind of knows the game is up and is sort of collectively shrugging their shoulders. As I recall Exxon Valdez, there was this sense that, you know, things shouldn't be like this. Of course, they continued to be like this. That was me on my soapbox. Do apologize. So the final question is, what next? Where does, now that you've sort of written this edited volume and it's got such rich, different conceptual and empirical material in there, what do you hope both of you as individuals or as a group or as a broader academic field, what do you hope comes next?
If I can start, maybe Judy, I don't know.
I would say for this book, my personal hope is simply that people will understand that it's an open access volume. And I hope that many of the chapters will find lives in the classroom and on the desks of policymakers or whatever, because it really is, there is such a range of voices there, but you know, there's a coherent volume as well. But I think that a lot of the chapters would lend themselves to classroom use. As far as my own work, I keep giving all these interviews about China and the COP in Glasgow, you know? And so I'm just still watching what China's doing there on the Belt and Road. And I don't think that's a story that's gonna go away anytime soon. And I feel that having become more sensitized to the many ways in which China is extracting and imposing, actually, you know, imposition is also a form of extraction, imposing its vision of the way the globe should develop, whether by enticement or coercion. Yeah, I think this is a story that for me doesn't go away. So, yeah.
I mean, again, you know, the subtitle of the book is Violence and Resistance. And I think that by giving it that subtitle, we, on the one hand, wanted to, I guess, on the one hand, you know, emphasize the horror that can surround extractive activities, but also to try and give some note of hope as well, as different forms of resistances are tested out. And some of which also, proved to be useful, break new ground on at least taming some of the worst consequences of natural resource extraction. So that's one thing. So there's an empirical desire that came, you know, that we wanted to put across with the book. We also hope that the book expands as well, quite clearly, a more academic conceptualization of how we understand extraction and extractivism, thinking about the logics and practices. And I think that it's a book as well in that sense, in terms of expanding conceptualizations, expanding an understanding of extraction. It's a book as well that can be applied as well to talking about, discussing, attempting to understand other aspects of extraction and extractivism that we haven't covered. There is more out there yet to be said about these processes. And history is not over yet either. And so, there are new developments that are taking place, such as, you know, deep sea mining that are on the cards. We are also seeing these rich billionaires beginning to think about movements off planet, in fact, to think about the extraction of natural resources, whether it be on the moon or Mars or goodness knows where else, and asteroid belts and all of that. So all of that, we need also conceptual tools to understand what goes on there too, right? And I think that this book has some level of importance with regards to that. It can be extended in that direction to look at these new processes. And so I think that I would hope that the book has a lasting significance to academic debate and academic reflection on that basis. In terms of my own work, I continue in this project that looks at river rights, this project called Riverine Rights. I'm also involved in another project as well that's looking at the violence surrounding renewable energy development in Africa, which is led by the Peace Research Institute here in Oslo and funded by the Norwegian Research Council. And I'm in discussions with colleagues about the development of projects that will actually look specifically at the governance of space, the governance of natural resource extraction when it's off planet.
Am I allowed to say far out in a comedy? Indeed. 1960s?
Yeah, it is voice. Far out.
With that, I'd like to thank my guests, John Andrew McNish and Judith Shapiro. I'm Mark Hudson. You've been listening to the New Books Network podcast, and all of the details about the book that we've been talking about are there on the website. Thanks for listening.